thing to the governing process to help mislead the country into war. I don't know whether it's going to be indictable in a court of law. We're going to know that in a day or two. But it will be indicted in the High Court of History.
I don't think that's entirely fair. I think it's fair to say that Karl Rove has been far too political in the appointment process. He's deeply and has been since day one involved in who gets appointed to what. And that's probably a bad thing. And I've seen example after example that I think doesn't serve the public very well. But you have to conclude simply because it's true.
Is that little silly bow tie strangling all the blood that's going to your little head? This is ridiculous. You're going to try to pretend that Karl Rove didn't play a role in propagandizing the necessity to go into this imperialist war in Iraq? Rove, who is part of the Whig group, the White House Iraq group, that was doing its various offices, special plan types of propagandizing and miscues and lies and deceits, distortions, leaks, and everything else under the sun. Man, it just never stops with you cowards. If you fools had the heart to go out and face those Iraqis that you talk so much smack about out on the field, on the streets, it'd be another thing. But then again, you'd be too scared to go out and face the people in the Hurricane Sam region of New Orleans. Because you know what would happen there. Maybe even worse. Check it out. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 Whiskey in Santa Cruz, 107.5 North Carolina, LUBER.com, the world, Upstart Radio, the stratosphere, and RadioFraud.net, the universe, slave time. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into the issues of energy and how it's playing itself out in the market capital world of today. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers, here we go again, and hello especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
Going to go into is a segment dealing with the privatized war on energy. You know, in the hierarchical privatized world created by the ruling elite, the control of energy and its sources is vital to the order maintaining its control over the planet in general. And with vast energy resources in and already creating a crisis on a planetary level, humanity is approaching the crossroads. We're going to explore this a little bit, starting off with Richard Heinberg. He's author of the book The Party's Over and Party Down. And Heinberg goes into some of the issues that we're about to address. So first off, here's Heinberg talking about the importance of the exploitation of energy by empires. So let's check this out and see what he means.
Normal reality is changing. It seems to me that we are, in fact, living in an oil empire, and like all of the great empires of the past, this empire is in the beginning stages of again, what all empires tend to do, it's in the beginning stages of collapse because of resource depletion. We can trace back civilizations for thousands of years, and most of them have declined for essentially the same reason. Only the nature of the resource is different. In most cases, it's topsoil or fresh water. In this case, it's oil and water and topsoil. I like to use 1950 as a reference point because it was the year I was born. Back in 1950, the U.S. was the world's foremost oil-producing nation, the world's foremost oil-exporting nation. When I talk to my students about this, most of them are in their 20s, and they tend to assume that the U.S. has always been importing oil. No, oil is what made the U.S. rich and powerful. We were the Saudi Arabia of the early 20th century. We were exporting oil. Seven out of every eight barrels of oil used in World Wars I and World War II by the Allies to win those wars came from American oil wells. We were also the world's largest exporter of machine tools, manufactured goods, world's foremost creditor nation. We were loaning money to the rest of the world, and we were self-sufficient in nearly all resources. How things have changed. Now we're the world's foremost oil importing nation by far, the world's foremost debtor nation, again by far, world's foremost importer of manufactured goods and non-petroleum resources, and of course our manufacturing jobs are fleeing to other countries. Now is this just the result of mismanagement? Well, of course there's been plenty of that, but I would suggest that it all has to do with the depletion of the resource that made all of that possible in the first place.
So as you heard Heinberg go into some of the issues, how Sam used to be the foremost oil exploiter and exporter in the world, the Saudi Arabia of the early 20th century. And this relates to basically how in all societies that are a hierarchical base, those that can exploit energy in its various forms most ruthlessly in many cases are those that surge ahead in this competition form of existence. So the control of energy takes place in many forms. The human form of energy, human energy, slaves, human exploitation within that construct, the brain draining of populations because you've decimated their country. So often the youngest, brightest, most able to have mobility will come to, you know, your particular region, so on. So you're exploiting their intellectual energy powers, so on and so forth. But as he went into Sam's loss of oil energies, once it reached its peak and had to become an importer nation, you started to see some of, in a sense, the luster, how a slave would point out the illusion start to dry up. Now, this has to do with the fact, in part, that these types of societies are not cooperative societies within or without the particular region that they're from. They're about super exploitation. So when, in the case of oil, it was not no longer available within its own country like it once was, that meant that it was no longer as super exploitable. And for the capitalist frame of mind, super exploitable means cheap energy, you know, Walmart type energy, you know, having workers work for virtually nothing. Now, if one looks at like the British Empire and all of them, one can also see that part of their decline was a part of their decline of being able to exploit resources and energies throughout the world. So the loss of different regions was related to the loss of them being able to exploit people's labor, exploit people's land, etc., etc. And you can see how the mindset of empires, as we're setting this up, is locked into maintaining control of resources, energy, even if those energies, resources, are finite. But they're not looking at it like that. They're looking at it within the short-term range of control. So let's move on as this dynamic grows and processes itself out. So next, Heimberg goes on into the U.S. growth through the exploitation of renewable versus non-renewable energies.
It all started in the 1860s when the first oil wells were discovered in Pennsylvania, and very quickly a smart young fellow by the name of John D. Rockefeller hit upon the idea of cornering the market, and he became the richest individual in the world, and also his company, Standard Oil, became the world's first multinational corporation. And at first the problem was figuring out what to do with this stuff because it was so cheap. The reason oil was grown for in the first place was that we were running out of another resource. See, resource depletion tends to shake people out of their habits. We were running out of the resource of whale oil, which is being used for home illumination. So the idea was put upon of using rock oil, which is the literal translation of petroleum, in its place, hence the petroleum industry. And for the first several decades, virtually all produced oil was refined into kerosene for home lighting. But there was so much of the stuff that they had to find other uses for it. So for machinery, lubrication, for running ships and heating homes, and eventually for the internal combustion engine. This graph is very important because it shows us the quantity of energy supplied by non-renewable fuels such as oil, gas, coal, nuclear electricity, and the amount of energy supplied by renewable sources such as wind, wind, hydroelectricity, and so on. And you'll see all of the growth since 1850 has been in non-renewable energy in the U.S. economy. Interestingly, there's not that much more renewable energy in the U.S. economy now than there was in 1850, only about twice as much today as 150 years ago.
Now, once again, this touches into the irresponsibility of the hierarchical order. And being a hierarchical order where it fights against humanity's autonomy, of course, one can see how it's going to conduct and construct itself in an irresponsible way. And so this is all part of the design. But it's quite fascinating that from 150 years ago, the underdevelopment intentionally of renewable or living energy systems investments, energy systems, is not something that's prioritized. And that's because the whole market thing is, let's collapse around the system, the energy supply that we already have in our control, maintain control, use it as a weapon against other countries to keep them at bay or keep them in check. And that way we can control the production and the process of human development. Now, of course, as we know with fossil fuels, a dead energy system, which is why they call it fossil fuels, this has had a catastrophic impact. So with all of human creativity and ingenuity, we more than could have developed a lot of these living energy systems far more advanced than what they are now, wind power, solar power, and so on and so forth. But the whole privatized hierarchical model is in opposition to that, unless they were in direct self-assured position of being in control, which of course they weren't in. So of course for them, it's not about even taking a chance. It's about this goose stepping along on this deadly path. So this once again helps highlight how sick and vicious this whole order is. And when Heinberg talked about how, you know, they had so much cheap oil, they were looking for other means to use it and so on and so forth, but through the whole privatized ownership construct for wealth and all of that, there was no real investment on the possible damage that fossil fuel could have on human beings, other species, or the planet in general. And as we've seen with other elements and chemicals that have been in, mixed together, you know, like pesticides and DDT, what people like Rachel Carson had to go through, you know, when her book Silent Spring was released, to in exposing the deadly effects of these pesticide agents, was basically to be under the wrath of the privatized hierarchical orthodoxy that just wants to exploit various resources for profit. So next, let's move on as Heinberg goes into fossil fuel as a form of energy slave, as we move into another step of the allurement of this energy system and the death trap, in a sense of it.
Us have become accustomed to a way of life that is extraordinary by any historical standards. If the services performed for us by fossil fuels had to be done by human muscle power, as was done only a few decades ago, each of us would have to have about 300 slaves to supply the same horsepower. And I don't know about you, I can kind of get off on the idea of having one or two energy slaves to pick up my dirty socks and so on, but to have 300 and think of that as normal, it's extraordinary.
Okay, so basically he's talking about the fact that, you know, cars and all, you know, a human being can put out about a half a horsepower of energy. But, you know, we have cars that, you know, have 250, 300, 400 horsepower and beyond. So you basically have, you know, a whole hood full of slaves, in a sense, all being able to be at the luxury of your foot because of what fossil fuel can produce. And when you break it down or go into other aspects of plastics, fertilizers being produced through fossil fuels, drying one's clothes and other things, the washing machines, dryers that are built through metals and through the whole process, transportation, you can see how much of our lives is based in an oil-based society. But once again, this has been something that has been going on since the 1860s. And long past the peak of discovery of oil in this country, and long past the production of oil in this country, there's been a continuous ramping up of the use of this energy system like it's finite, even though many know, including the rulers, that is not. So they're creating a condition of chaos. But their system is based in a chaotic type of approach. So now let's move to the next step. As here Heimberg goes into the oil peak discovery and the oil peak production in America and the world, and what that means in many ways for our future.
Now, this graph really shows the 20th century in a way that most of us are not accustomed to thinking about it, but it reveals a lot. The red vertical bars are oil discovery, and of course the black line is oil production in the lower 48 U.S. Oil discovery peaked in the 1930s with East Texas, and oil production peaked, as we saw in the film, in 1970. Now, as a result of the U.S. oil production peak in 1970, literally everything changed. U.S. being self-sufficient in oil now was becoming more and more dependent on resources from elsewhere. The Carter Doctrine in 1979, of course, there was a global economic slump that resulted. The CIA woke up to peak oil. This intelligence memorandum from 1977, recently declassified, says the Soviet oil industry is in trouble. Soviet oil production will soon peak, probably as early as next year, and certainly not later than the early 1980s. Actually, the Soviet oil production peak is in 1987. There's some evidence to suggest that this CIA memo resulted in the policies of the Reagan administration attempting to bankrupt the Soviet Union by lowering global oil prices through an agreement with Saudi Arabia to drive down prices during the 1980s, and then to start a proxy war in Afghanistan that would cause the Soviets to produce oil at the maximum possible rate in order to earn revenues from oil sales so that they could pay for the arms race and also for the Afghanistan war. It worked 2 years after the Soviet oil production peak. The Soviet economy went belly up. Well, we're seeing the same phenomenon in country after country. Of the 44 principal oil-producing countries in the world, 24 are already past peak. So we're not talking about prognostication, really. We're not talking about crystal ball gazing. We're looking at history as it's happening. Every year, it's possible to record another country, UK, Norway, Denmark, Oman, going over that peak and finding itself unable to produce as much oil as it did in the past. Global oil discovery peaked in the 1960s. This particular slide is from the PowerPoint presentation of the executive vice president of ExxonMobil, Henry Longwell. Thank you very much, Henry. Didn't get it from him personally, but from his website. Thank you so much. And it shows very clearly discovered oil volumes peaking in the 1960s. Now, at the very end there to the right, there's a little uptick, a little note of optimism. But look at that more closely, add more recent data. Fresh oil finds in 2001, 2002, very disappointing, resuming that downward trend. And 2003, Ken White, senior editor of the IHS report, Discoveries and Highlights, he says 2003 didn't produce large unpredictable finds, and Chris Klebowski, editor of Petroleum Review, described the year's exploration results as little short of horrifying in a recent editorial, noting that we would probably have to go back to the early 1920s to find a year when fewer large oil discoveries were made. Back in the 1960s, we were discovering much more oil every year than was being extracted from the ground, and that trend is gradually reduced, so that now we're burning about 3 barrels of oil to 4 barrels of oil for every one that's discovered every year today. Oil Depletion Analysis Center in London and the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, also in Britain, keep very close track of current reserve and production figures. This is the ASPO 2004 scenario. The 2003 scenario showed a global peak around 2010 for all petroleum liquids. The 2004 scenario has that advanced to 2007. The industry has been reluctant to comment on this, but if one reads between the lines, it's clear that at least some people in the industry know what's going on. John Thompson, president of ExxonMobil Exploration, says, "We estimate that world and gas production from existing fields is declining at an average rate of 4 to 6% a year to meet projected demand in 2015. Industry will have to add 100 million oil equivalent barrels a day of new production. That's equal to about 80% of today's production level. In other words, by 2015, we will need to find, develop, and produce a volume of new oil and gas that's equal to 8 out of every 10 barrels being produced today. In addition, the cost associated with providing this additional oil and gas is expected to be considerably more than what industry is now spending. Translation, it's not going to happen." Also, academic geologists, energy experts are reaching similar conclusions. Werner Zittel and Jörg Schindler, scientific advisors to the German parliament, their report Future World Oil Supply concluded basically the same things. Production peak of individual fields is already historical fact, and almost all large oil fields have already passed their production maximum and are in decline. And the pattern has been observed for more than 30 years. The aggregate decline of mature regions is getting steeper with every new member of the peak club. In order to keep overall production just flat, ever fewer regions have to increase their production. Therefore, it's very likely that the peak of world oil production will be reached before 2010 at the latest.
Now, once again, this helps highlight the kind of suicide mission that the order has put the planet in. And it's not, and I'm not saying this because of the aspect of them running out, of the planet running out of fossil fuel, or at least recoverable, easily recoverable fossil fuel, and how that's going to have a shattering impact on the planet's life, because in many ways, it's say there was enough fossil fuel for the year 2200, we would still be on the same collision course, because these bandits are burning up the planet just as quickly as they're burning up fossil fuel. In other words, we're caught in a quandary. Every time you turn around, and you've heard me go into these various issues of, recently, the big hurricane event that happened the past year was not the Hurricane Sam / Katrina or anything like that, to many scientists. It was a hurricane that touched down in the southern part of Brazil, where in recorded human history, no hurricane had ever touched upon in that region before and had always thought of not being able to produce a hurricane because of, you know, a combination of water or the warmness of the water or lack thereof, etc., etc. But right before the scientists' eyes, they saw the eye of the storm touch down and make its way all the way in to the southern part of Brazil. And many other aspects of the Antarctic melting before our eyes, so on and so forth. So once again, the irresponsibility of a ruling hierarchical order is putting the planet on a collision course of barbarity. And how do they respond to the lack of discoverable fossil fuel? Well, to play war games, basically. As Heinberg mentioned, the CIA came out with their own documents talking about the Soviet oil production being in trouble. And of course, they and the empire in general sought ways to use that as a weapon and used one of their most important allies, the Saudis, to help in the process by flooding the markets to put the Soviets in a vulnerable position because they were going to have to ramp up the sale and production of this product, and they wouldn't be able to get, since they're all in a market system, their quote-unquote market price. So here you have a perpetual manipulation within this, like it is a grand chessboard game. And human lives, the species lives, and the fate of many things on this planet are at stake. And these mad dogs are perpetuating the dangers of the planet and the humans and other species on this planet because of how they're fixated on control and domination and exploitation of energy. So once again, we have a situation where we see those in the exploitative mode would stop at no ends to manipulate political, social issues to their end. And this puts a lot of things in a very dangerous situation when you think about how, with even if you don't believe in the peak type of oil crisis, it's clear that they're manipulating and playing war games, war chess games around energy, and have always done that. And as things become more and more intense around the world concerning that, the intensity of the beast of the state towards its population intensifies. And as the population, or at least elements of it, resist and try to have a society go in more sustainable, humane ways, the resistance from the hierarchical order fights back. Now, here's Michael Clare. He's with, this Peace and Justice Institute. He's written several books. He goes into the U.S. relationship, its beginning relationships with Saudi Arabia. And once again, this is to help build up the idea of the chessboard game concerning energies, energy systems, controls, and exploitation of their various resources by those who believe in the hierarchical order.
This relationship with Saudi Arabia really began during World War II, when the United States came to the conclusion that after the war was over, after World War II would be over, that the U.S. would become increasingly dependent on oil from the Middle East. that our domestic supplies would eventually run out, and that the only place in the world that would be able to supplant a decline, ultimate decline in Western Hemisphere supplies of oil, would be the Persian Gulf area. And up until that time, the U.S. had very little interest in the area. We didn't even have diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia until like 1943, and there were no links with the country. But during World War II, the State Department began to establish a relationship with Saudi Arabia in the interest of gaining access to its oil. And in fact, in 1945, President Franklin Roosevelt, who was very close to his own death, February 1945, traveled to the Middle East and met with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud, the founder of the modern Saudi monarchy. And they reached an agreement, a gentleman's agreement, that the United States would protect the Saudi royal family against all of its various enemies in return for privileged access to Saudi oil. And that agreement really has been the basis for U.S. ties with Saudi Arabia up until the present. And a lot of military policies that we think of in other terms really hinge from that, like the Truman Doctrine and the Eisenhower Doctrine and the Carter Doctrine and the Nixon Doctrine, all entail to some degree or another U.S. role in protecting Saudi Arabia against potential enemies. And I would say right now that a lot of our involvement in the Persian Gulf stems from this basic policy.
So once again, within a hierarchical sphere, the collaboration that the bandits within the order make amongst themselves has nothing to do with other societies that are on a course or striving for a course that is trying to work in a cohesive way to maintain a decent existence for the masses of people. No, it's all about making deals with other demons that happen to have a particular energy system under their feet, or source under their feet, that you want to collaborate and exploit with. To hell with everything else. It's interesting that when Roosevelt met with this Abdul dude, he was, the Saudi dude was accompanied by what? Slaves. Human slaves. The Saudi, well, they still don't know. That's a whole nother story. But, they outwardly, still played the slave game, back then. With no shame. Now, this had no impact on Roosevelt because old Roosevelt had a whole busload, nation load of slaves from his country that were on the exploitation cotton field lines in an indentured servitude post the chattel slavery era. So it was basically all good. And the slaves that this Abdul had looked a whole lot like the ones that were from the plantation in America. So once again, they all had a merry time. Now, it's also interesting though that as Claire went into the aspect about the various doctrines that others have passed, spoke about, I'm talking about raggedy administrators for the ruling elite, presidents, what have you, have all had a similar theme since Roosevelt. So you mentioned Truman or Eisenhower or Jimmy Carter, whatever. Well, actually, Carter's doctrine on this issue was made at the State of the Union speech he gave on January 23rd, 1980. And here's a little bit what Carter had to say. He said, quote, let our position be absolutely clear. An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the U.S., the United States of America. And such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force." Unquote. So basically, they were outlining a doctrine of war for U.S. imperial interests. Now, within that context, you can see that Boy George, the oil barons, the neocons, and all the other likes are working right in alignment with this doctrine. There is no real difference within the mindset and actions, especially when you put into context the particular struggles that the various nations are maneuvering themselves in over control of energy resources. There is really, Jimmy Carter could have just as easily have been an oil baron. He just as easily could have been a neocon. Because they all understand that whether your emphasis is on Israel or protecting Israel, or of course protecting the ultimate master, the capitalist captains of industry, that you can't do any of those without control within a hierarchical system of the important energy resources like oil. I mean, that's just the real world. So they're all resource bandits. They all understand that. And they all know that war is something that must be a part of their policy for them to maintain it. Now, next, here Claire goes into the plan that Sam has set up to help Saudi Arabia set up its own form of joint ventures. This is in the years gone past as things were developing on how these oil collaborations would be set up. So check this out.
During World War II, when the United States government came to the conclusion that it would be necessary for the U.S. to import a lot of oil from Saudi Arabia, the U.S. government actually began to plan for creation of a state-owned oil company that would manage all of the oil concessions in Saudi Arabia. This is based on the model of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which later became the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and is the basis of British Petroleum, one of the largest companies today. That was originally a state-owned corporation. Winston Churchill was the person who helped set all that up, so that the British government would have control over access to Iranian oil. And the U.S. State Department actually began to lay the groundwork for establishing a similar company, which might have been called the American Arabian Oil Company or something like it, but that would be U.S. government owned. And the oil companies balked at having the U.S. government get into the oil business, and they persuaded Roosevelt to back off from that scheme. But the idea of a joint American company that would manage the concession was preserved in the establishment of Aramco, the Arabian American Oil Company, which was a kind of joint venture of the largest American oil companies at the time. And Aramco ran Saudi Arabian oil industry from the mid-1940s to the mid-1970s, when the concessions were nationalized by the Saudi government. But Aramco continued to operate as a management and a technical and a marketing arm of the Saudi National Oil Company. And when Iran tried to nationalize its oil under Prime Minister
Mossadegh, the CIA organized a coup d'etat and overthrew Mossadegh and replaced him with direct control by the Shah of Iran. And there was some consideration of that, I think, in Saudi Arabia. But I think the relationship in Saudi Arabia was different in the sense that the Saudi royal family is so closely linked to the United States government that I think there were all kinds of understandings that took place at that time that there would be no fundamental change in the nature of the relationship, except that on paper the Saudi government would have ownership of Aramco's holdings, but the basic situation where American oil companies manage a lot of the oil business in Saudi Arabia, that that would continue, and that U.S. forces would remain tied to the Saudi government as they have during all of this time. So I don't think it presented the same sort of anxiety and alarm in Washington that you had in the 1950s with Mossadegh and Iran. I think something that did worry the U.S. government a lot was the possibility that the royal family would be overthrown by similar forces that overthrew the Shah of Iran in 1979-1980. There was a popular uprising led by Ayatollah Khomeini and other Islamic fundamentalists, overthrew the Shah and established the government that you now have in Iran. And the U.S. was terribly worried that a similar upheaval would occur in Saudi Arabia and that the royal family would be overthrown, thereby jeopardizing the special relationship that the U.S. has. And at that time, in 1981, when there was a uprising in Mecca against the royal family, which was put down with the help of the U.S., in the background anyway, President Reagan said at the time that we will not allow Saudi Arabia to become another Iran, meaning that the U.S. will not allow the royal family to be overthrown. And we've been beefing up our military presence in Saudi Arabia ever since. And of course, it's this military presence in Saudi Arabia, this close tie between the royal family and the U.S. government, that underlies the terrorist conspiracy of Osama bin Laden and his associates.
So once again, this goes into the aspect of how, you know, these guys are gate and maintenance keepers for the hierarchical order. As Claire mentioned, when there was an uprising against the little royal family in Saudi Arabia, there was the U.S. Empire helping the royal hierarchical family structure out. And old Ronald the Crip Reagan talking about how we will not allow Saudi Arabia to be another Iran. So they maintain these orders in the same way that they maintain the world population locked into a fossil, a dead energy system, this fossil fuel stuff. They attack portions of their population as they see them disposable or not necessary in a particular era, thereby degrading the human potential of participating in creating a more humane society, and then inflame it in with all of its contradictions in these chaotic wars and stuff. This helps outline how barbaric this whole method is, and how dangerous of a situation that we are finding ourselves spiraling into. Now also, to show you some of the overlapping interest, of course, and inner turmoil conflicts that happen, Great Polish just came out with another article called OPEC and the Economic Conquest of Iraq. Why Iraq Still Sells Its Oil a la Cartel, Twilight of the Neocon Gods. And I'm going to go into some of this article a little bit. as we explore this whole dynamic of the exploiters of energy. 2.5 years and $202 billion into the war in Iraq, the United States has at least one significant new asset to show for it: effective membership through our control of Iraq's energy policy in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, the Arab-dominated oil cartel. Just what to do with the proxy power has been almost since President Bush's first inaugural, the cause of a pitched battle between neoconservatives at the Pentagon on the one hand and the State Department and the oil industry on the other. At issue is whether Iraq will remain a member in good standing of OPEC, upholding production limits and thereby high prices, or a munition spoiler that could topple the Arab oligopoly. According to insiders and to documents obtained from the State Department, the neocons once in command are now in full retreat. Iraq's system of oil production, after a year of failed free market experimentation, is being recreated almost entirely on the lines originally laid out by Saddam Hussein. Under the quiet direction of U.S. oil company executives working with the State Department, the Iraqis have discarded the neocon vision of a laissez-faire privatized oil operation in favor of one shackled to quotas set by OPEC, which have been key to the 148% rise in oil prices since the beginning of 2002. This rise is estimated to have cost the U.S. economy 1.5% of its GDP, or a third of its total growth during the period. Given this economic blow, and given that OPEC states accounts for 46% of America's oil imports, it may seem odd that the United States, quote, remaking of Iraq would allow for a national oil company that props up OPEC's price gouging, and in fact their original scheme for reconstruction, at least the one favored by neoconservatives, was to privatize Iraq's oil entirely and thereby undermine the oil cartel. One intellectual godfather of this strategy was Ariel Cohen of the Heritage Foundation, who in September 2002 published with Gerald P. O'Driscoll Jr. a post-invasion plan, quote, "The Economic Road to Economic Prosperity for a Post-Saddam Iraq," unquote, that put forward the idea of using Iraq to smash OPEC. Cohen explained to me how such an extraordinary geopolitical feat might be accomplished. OPEC maintains high oil prices by suppressing production through a quota system effectively imposed on each member by Saudi Arabia, which reigns by dint of its overwhelming reserves. The Saudis, to maintain their control on pricing, must keep a lid on production from other members, particularly Iraq, which has the second greatest proven reserves. Under Saddam Hussein, Iraq adhered to the OPEC quota limit, historically set to equal Iran's now 3.96 million barrels a day via state ownership of all fields. Cohen reasoned that if Iraq's fields were broken up and sold off, a dozen competing operators would quickly crank up production from the individual patches to the maximum possible, swiftly raising Iraq's total output to 6 million barrels a day. This extra crude would flood world petroleum markets. OPEC would dissolve into mass cheating and overproduction. Oil prices would fall over a cliff, and Saudi Arabia, both economically and politically, would fall to its knees. Let me stop right there for a sec. Now, we went into it a whole thing before about the whole big oil neocon thing, or a segment on the show, a while ago, months ago. And we dealt with the fact that what happened when this strategy was first taken off was big oil was making big profits. Now, they didn't mind a lot of the charges into the Iraq sphere of, through war, because, well, this is a war imperial system. And they didn't really care how they, the neocons and others got the U.S. into this imperial war. But once some of their game plan was starting to more or less affect their economic profits. But then they said, we're not playing that. Because basically you're dealing with elements of the captain of industry. And the captains of industry, they don't play that stuff about you cutting into their profits because you want to bring down Saudi Arabia or break up OPEC. Now, of course, that's what the state of Israel wants. So you can see how the neocons' agenda would be aligned in that particular way. Because from their vantage point, they want, of course, the U.S. to maintain control over the oil, but they want, just like big oil and other, you know, capitalist enterprises, but they also want the state of Israel to have a more and more prominent place in the region and in the world to the U.S. empire and the elites. And decapitating the Saudi family and Saudi in general from a vantage point of its power and influence through OPEC and its long-term connection with the U.S., as we've gone over with Roosevelt, the Carter Doctrine, and on, would be a good strategy. But the capitalists aren't, you know, they don't care about that if it wouldn't hurt their interests, but this would hurt their interests, their economic interests. So that's where you saw big oil move in and say, this is not working out. Now, let me go on. In plotting the destruction of OPEC, the neocons failed to predict the virulent resistance of insurgent forces, the U.S. oil industry itself. From the outset of the planning for war, U.S. oil executives have thrown in their lot with the pragmatists at the State Department and the National Security Council. Within weeks of the first inaugural, prominent Iraqi expatriates, many with ties in the U.S. industry, were invited to secret discussions directed by Pamela Quadrude, an NSC economics expert now employed at State. Quote, it quickly became an oil group, unquote, one participant, Fala Aljubri, told me. Aljubri, an advisor to Amarada's Hess oil trading arm and to investment banking giant Goldman Sachs, who once served as a back channel between the U.S. and Iraq during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administration, cut ties to the Hussein regime following the invasion of Kuwait. The working group's ideas about the war has been far less starry-eyed than those of the neocons. Quote, the petroleum industry, the chemical industry, the banking industry, they'd hoped that Iraq would go for a revolution like in the past and government was shut down for 2 or 3 days. Unquote, Al-Jabari told me. Quote, you'd have martial law and say Iraq is being liberated and everybody stay where they are. Everything as is. Unquote. On this plan, Hussein would simply have been replaced by former Ba'athist general. One candidate was General Nazar Qajari, Saddam's former army chief of staff, who at the time was under house arrest in Denmark pending charges for war crimes. Qajari was seen in Iraq a month after the U.S. invasion, but he soon disappeared and has not been heard from since. Roughly 6 months before the invasion, the Bush administration designated Philip Carroll to advise the Iraqi oil ministry once U.S. tanks entered Baghdad. Carroll had been CEO of Berth Floral Corporation, now a major contractor in Iraq, and earlier of Royal Dutch Shell U.S. Division. In May 2003, a month after his arrival in Iraq, Carroll made headlines when he told the Washington Post that Iraq might break with OPEC. Quote, Iraqis have, from time to time, because of compelling national interests, elected to opt out of quota systems and pursue their own path. They may elect to do that same thing. To me, it's a very important national question. Carroll later told me, though, that he personally would not have been supported of privatizing oil fields. Quote, Nobody in their right mind would have thought of doing that, he said. Soon after Carroll resigned his post in September 2003, the new provisional government appointed an oil minister, Ibrahim Bahar Olum, who had been maneuvered into the job by the neocon's favorite, Chalabi. Quickly fired Mohammed al-Jarabi, chief of Iraq's state oil marketing organization. Let me stop right there for a sec. Now, this goes on to this basically, you know, jostling back and forth that various entities wanted. But when the situation became clear about what was going to happen to the various oil OPEC cartels, that once again was when the real conflict happened internally. Now, the reason why I mention this is that whether it's coming from a neocon construct and their little angle, whether it's coming from a big oil or the chemical or the weapons producers who have deals and contracts with a number of these Arab states that produce a lot of oil and would see the fall of a lot of them, a lot of their selling weapons to them if their economies crash. At the end of the day, how they all operate is through military force, putting the imperial boots out on the ground for the destruction of humanity, and putting various mercenaries / police, martial law-like boots, in the case of New Orleans, to smash our rights for control, and the desecration of the masses of, you know, of the people within this hierarchical privatized market system. So it once again makes it clear that it's beyond one group. It's the whole hierarchical setup that has to be crushed. Now, Paulus goes on much longer in the article. We don't have time for all of that. But that recent article, and then like the issue of the whole neocons also conflict with big oil and a previous slave, helps process out that they're all for war, they're all for destruction, and they all channel their energies in a militaristic way. And that's what has to be dealt with at the end of the day. But next, let's move on and go into Claire, Michael Claire, as he outlines who are some of the other big players in this liquid game of death after, of course, Saudi Arabia.
After Saudi Arabia, the next biggest holders of oil are Kuwait, Iran, and Iraq, and the United Arab Emirates. Now, U.S. already has a very tight relationship with Kuwait. American forces are permanently based there, and we've already gone to war twice on Kuwait's behalf. So it's clear that Kuwait is very closely tied to the United States. Iran is, and Iraq are two of the three countries named in President Bush's axis of evil. And I don't think that's accidental. I think that the fact that Iran and Iraq have moved away from the United States in past years is deeply troubling to American strategists. You know, and I do think they would like to overthrow one way or the other both of those governments and install friendly governments that would allow American oil companies to come in and develop their resources. And I do think that's part of the thinking behind the Axis of Evil speech. United Arab Emirates are also closely tied to the United States. Like Kuwait, there are American bases there or facilities, We sell them most of their weapons. There's all kinds of connections between the U.S. and the UAE. They really can't defend themselves. They rely on the United States. So of the five we mentioned, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE are closely aligned with the United States. Two, Iran and Iraq, are opposed, and these are two of the three countries that President Bush has singled out for American military pressure in the months and years ahead.
So check it out. Here you have Saudi Arabia. Of course, Sam has close ties as we've gone over. Kuwait, he has bases there, like in Saudi Arabia, close ties. One of the other major oil producers. United Arab Emirates, close ties, facilities, selling all types of weapons and everything else. And then the other two major ones that are producers, or have oil, they're not really producing it, but they have oil, Iraq and Iran. Iran is part of their quote-unquote axis of evil. In Iraq, they're occupying right now. So you can see how the relationship for the imperial machine of controlling the energy systems is pivotal for them maintaining their imperial order. And how it's crucial to understand that imperial exploitation goes hand in hand. These guys aren't just doing things arbitrarily. This is all part of the diabolical setup. Whether you are a weapon seller, a chemical seller, big oil, or neocon, you understand that to maintain your grip, control, and influence in whatever mechanism of the machine that you operate out of, the U.S. Empire has to maintain its control over the energy resources throughout the world. Because if the empire loses its control over the energy resources, it ceases to be an empire. And all of your dreams, whatever they may be, will go up in smoke. That's in part why we have to destroy these clowns at part of their source, in their main entrance, and see it within that construct. Now next, let's move on to William Bloom. He's the author of the book Rogue State, and amongst others, he has a few out. Here he outlines, though, the shameless hypocrisy of Sam, as in 1996, this is during crime bill days, you know. Crime bill's administration gathered 27, quote-unquote, well, 27 misleaders. And what was the topic of this gathering? On anti-terrorism. Let's check out what Sam himself was doing at that very same time.
1996, the U.S. assembled 27 world leaders in Egypt at an anti-terror conference after a wave of suicide bombings had killed dozens of people in Israel. And at the conference, President Clinton said, "We must be clear in our condemnation of those who resort to terror. Violence has no place in the future we all seek in the Middle East." Unquote. At the very same time in Iraq, the U.S. was supporting with millions of dollars the Iraqi National Accord, which was using car bombs and other bombings in Baghdad and other cities, trying to destabilize Saddam Hussein. It was estimated that the bombings had taken the lives of more than 100 civilians in Baghdad alone during the preceding few years. And then 2 weeks after this conference, the same countries met in Washington for a follow-up on counterterrorism, and amongst the topics they discussed were the flow of funds to terrorist groups. Of course, there's no mention of the flow of funds from Washington to such groups. Yeah, also in 96, which was and remains a body blow to civil liberties in the U.S. In many ways, against aliens and people seeking asylum and American prisoners, all kinds of people have been hurt by that law, and it bars financial transactions between American corporations and countries accused of supporting terrorism. And 4 months after the bill was passed, the Clinton administration quietly exempted Sudan to allow a U.S. oil company to negotiate an oil deal. At the same time, Syria was granted an exemption to encourage participation by Damascus in the Middle East process. So they had this law which bars American corporations from doing business with countries accused of supporting terrorism, but as soon as it helps American corporations, they waive the law.
So once again, here's our friend Sudan. Man, it never ends with those little Christopher Columbuses with turbans on. This once again helps expose how the state of Sudan, Bashir, and the rest of these little hoodlums are just a part of the satellite operation of the U.S. Empire. Here, they get off. They get an exemption from being considered a terrorist. Now, of course, Sam is in no position to call anyone a terrorist, but a terrorist knows a terrorist. But in 1996, this was during the same time that the country of the Sudan, led by the NIF, National Islamic Front, were waging their genocidal war against the South. Now, this is not the current one where they're waging their genocidal war against the black population in the West, Darfur, who also are fellow Muslims, but not Arab and don't have the Arabic identity, so they need to be cleansed out. At the same time, then and now, Sudan, or the Khartoum government, was carrying out its genocidal destruction of the Nuba people, some original people, literally, in the Nuba Mountains, where then and now they have their genocidal concentration camps. But, you know, these are hierarchical societies with their hierarchical ideologies, and, you know, the Khartoum government believes that those who roll around in the feces of Muhammad with an Arabic identity are somehow superior to the indigenous black population, so it's all good. And that's how the bandits operate. So once again, you can see how these deals between these demons for control, monopoly of energy resources plays into the hands of destruction of populations, indigenous and otherwise. Now, next, Michael Clare goes into the military war oil games in Kazakhstan and other stands regions, and how this is currently playing itself out. So check it out.
Operation Centraz Back, which is an annual exercise involving American troops and forces from what the military call the stands, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. The U.S. has annual training exercises with the military of those countries. And this goes back to 1997, I think, was the first one. And it reflects the Clinton administration's deep interest in the Caspian Sea. Clinton administration was very interested in the Caspian area as a source of oil and natural gas for the United States and for its allies, and had a lot of activity, military missions going in all of the time to try to establish military-to-military relationships with the forces of that area. You know, training missions coming in all the time, military aid agreements of various kinds, training and arms transfers in some cases. I think it's very interesting, for example, that the 10th Mountain Division, which is now in Uzbekistan as part of the activities in Afghanistan, that this was not the first time that they had been in that area. They had participated in the second or third of the Centrazbat exercises. So they were already familiar with the region and in some cases had operated out of the bases that are now being used in Afghanistan to practice for operations in that region, clearly showing U.S. military interest in what happens in that area. We already had agreements with these countries with the stands, certainly Kazakhstan and I think Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, for military-to-military contacts. That is where high-level American generals would go over there and meet with their equivalent-ranked people for annual discussions about common interests, or they would come over to the Pentagon and meet with people here. So there agreements were already in place. Clearly, they're now being expanded greatly, and you'll see now arms going into the area, a lot more training exercises, and as you say, bases being built up. I do think this is now going to be a major theater of operations for American forces and will remain so for far into the future. I think that this is deeply troubling to the Russian leadership. I think they are more concerned about this than they are about national missile defense. This is something that really threatens their geopolitical future. This is their part of the world. This was part of the Soviet Union. We forget that. It wasn't more than a decade or so ago when these countries were part of the USSR. It's as if the Russians were setting up bases in New Mexico and Arizona and Texas or something like that. That's the way, you know, you have to think about it from their point of view. And they consider this area very important to them strategically. And so I think the Russians are deeply troubled about the growing American presence. I think that they've kept their concerns pretty quiet because of this effort of Vladimir Putin, the president, to try to improve relations with the United States under the anti-terrorism campaign. I think he considers that a strategic necessity at a time when Russia is so weak and the United States is so powerful, and he wants the benefits of trade and contact with the West. But I do think that as time goes on, the Russian leadership is deeply concerned, is going to become more outspoken about the American presence in the area.
So, once again, you can see how the U.S. In various regions of the world, its collaborations with the Christopher Columbus's with turbans on in the Sudan, its alignment in Nigeria and the destruction of the Delta and those regimes over there, the 10th Mountain Division in Uzbekistan, and how this has been an ongoing issue, and how the Russian leadership is deeply troubled about SAM in these various regions. You can see once again how this is going to be under its present setup. The continuous process of wars, the continuous development of wars, death, destruction, chaos. And this is why it's beyond more than just little slogans like bring the troops home. Because what troops are you talking about, in part? And as we've gone over in this Imperial Peace Activist piece a little while ago, the show on that, how, you know, when they're building their bases and all of that, bringing their troops home doesn't even really mean bringing their troops home. Because they're not talking about dismantling their bases and getting out of the region. And once again, they're locked because of this is an energy, a fossil fuel reliant energy empire. For it to maintain itself as an imperial empire, it needs to maintain its control. And yes, that means war. So beyond everything else, the hierarchical imperial class knows that this is the priority. So you can lose certain lobbyists, certain influences, certain whatever, and still be the U.S. imperial machine. But if you lose in the resource war games, then the party is truly over. Now, in the meantime, they're setting the planet on a collision course for the planet's party to be over, literally. But for these barons of death, that's not a priority at all. Now, let's go back to who we started with, Richard Heimberg, as he talks about the decline of oil in the world, OPEC's role, and Cheney. Check this out.
Some recent headlines, of course, Shell has had to downgrade its reported reserves not once, but twice. Asian Wall Street Journal says OPEC producers are hitting limit on sweet crude production. OPEC takes a backseat as oil prices run wild. Indonesia's crude oil output is expected to fall below 1 million barrels per day in 2004, down from 1.09 million barrels per day the previous year due to declining productivity. So, again, where's all the oil left? As we see, Europe, Asia-Pacific, North America, former Soviet Union, Africa, South and Central America, and then the Middle East. Now, actually, the Middle East may not have quite as much as is shown there because, as we saw in the video, the reported reserves of OPEC countries in the Middle East are probably inflated, but nevertheless, there's a heck of a lot of hydrocarbons there. So what's the plan? Now, Dick Cheney, of course, is a former oil executive, and there's every reason to believe that he's familiar with the situation. He said in a speech in London, late 1999, by some estimates, quoting, there will be an average of 2% annual growth in global oil demand over the years ahead, along with, conservatively, a 3% natural decline in production from existing reserves. And he ended on an alarming note. That means by 2010, we will need on the order of an additional 50 million barrels a day. Now, the world currently produces and uses about 75 million barrels a day. So that means by 2010, two-thirds of what we're currently producing and using will have to be replaced by new production. And where's that going to come from? That's very unclear. Project for New American Century, in addition to outlining the need for American control of global oil reserves, also says the needed consensus in that regard will be difficult to achieve absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like the new Pearl Harbor. And of course, that's exactly what happened, the new Pearl Harbor on September 11th, 2001.
So once again, this helps outline that from Dick Cheney to what was written in PNAC, they know and understand that for the role of the U.S. empire to continue on its path of destruction and control, that it needs to control and maintain control of the global oil resource. Now, Cheney talks about, as a former oil exec in 99, that the world, by 2010, will need an extra 50 million barrels of oil a day. Now, of course, he and others know that that's not coming out of the ground. So, how what are they going to do about it? What they are doing about it? They're playing their grand chessboard game to manipulate and control the regions for their own behalf and using it as a weapon to offset
and control other nations and stuff. Now, they're not looking beyond just that little one game that they're playing. In other words, they're not looking towards the future, because within their whole mindset, this is the future. For those of us who want something beyond this chaos and destruction, that's where it takes us to see life beyond those people who follow within this exploitative order. Because death and destruction is surely where it's headed. Now, once again, this helps again highlight how, you know, these neocons and PNAC and all of that, that how these things overlap, and how you can be a neocon and you realizing that there needs to be a war and in the region for control. Now, your main emphasis may be to protect Israel, but you know that there's no protection of Israel without the U.S. empire controlling the oil reserves, so it overlaps. But once it got to the point where they were trying to break up OPEC and bring down Saudi Arabia, then that's when the captains of industry just came and slapped them down. But it's all about war for them in the meantime. That's how they operate. That's what they're about. And that's where they're leading the planet, to a perpetual war. And in this case, it will be complete destruction if they have their way. Now, here's William Bloom, who outlines, hypothetically, what he would say if he were president. So let's check out Bloom's statement to the world if he happened to be president of the U.S. empire.
If I were the president, I could stop terrorist attacks against the U.S. in a few days, permanently. I would first apologize to all the widows and orphans, the tortured and impoverished, and all the many millions of other victims of American imperialism. Then I would announce that America's global interventions have come to an end. I would then reduce the military budget by at least 90% and use the savings to pay reparations to the victims. That would be my first 2 days in office. Third day, I would be assassinated.
Well, that's the real world on that. And it wouldn't matter who hired them to cock the gun. It could come from the CIA, the Office of Special Plan, Big Oil, the neocons, the weapons industry. But at the end of the day, it'd be coming out of the same gun. That's the whole point. Now, as we wrap this up on Slave Tonight, in line with this fairy tale of being the president and what he would say, here's another fairy tale, another skit, in a way just as rehearsed and as fake as the one we played a few weeks ago with Boy George talking to these little G.I. Joes before camera. But this skit is done by a Democrat, their partner in crime as the administrators for the ruling order. This is a speech, a little clip from a speech by Carter in 1979, basically saying, "Don't worry, everything's okay."
Our children who will be born this year will come of age in the 21st century. What kind of society, what kind of world are we building for them? Will we ourselves be at peace? Will our children enjoy a better quality of life? Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world? Tonight, there is every sign that the state of our union is found.
Well, now we know just how much of a lie that is, as those of us who have come of age in the 21st century can see the fraud that was being said by these bandits back in 1979. What kind of society? A marginalized society imposed on the people of New Orleans as Hurricane Sam and all its viciousness came rushing through. What kind of world dipped into chaos as the bandits within the hierarchical order devilishly plan to control the last remaining drop of a finite dead energy source that is already plunging the world by itself within its use into chaos. Will there be peace? Well, just look over in Iraq, Afghanistan, Sudan, Congo, and on and on. And better quality of life, as cancer rates shoot up into the sky because of the way the chemical industries have been allowed to poison and affect and infect the bloodstream and beyond of humanity within this society and throughout the world, it's clear that these prophets of doom and these exploiters of energy in all of its form, human, species, and resources within the ground, have to be exploited out of existence for humanity's sake. Until next time, slave out.